Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Psychovertical Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Kirkpatrick. As promised, today I'm going to do a higher education kind of section of this podcast, where I'm going to go through some questions people have asked me recently about climbing. So hopefully there's not too much noise in this room. My wife, Vanessa, is sat behind me reading the newspaper when she should be editing, so... editing my book, so hopefully she won't be, you know, she's a very slow reader, so she'll be, you know, anyway. So the first question today, this is a long question, so I'll read through it. So this, I've got a few questions here. Some are about big wall climbing, some are about like winter climbing, so we'll go through a few and see how far we get. So the first one, now I usually try and leave out that there's often a bit at the beginning of these questions where people are like, "Hi, Andy, you're like amazing human being. I love you, blah, blah, blah." And I try and miss those bits out, but I shall include this one because it's kind of relevant. So, hi, Andy. Firstly, congratulations on higher education. This is the book, not the podcast. This is a fantastic book that is aimed squarely at geeks like myself and answers a lot of key questions that an experienced British trad climber has when heading to Yosemite for the first time. I'm currently reading it for the third time. Yes, I'm very slow in the uptake, and I'm due out this September, and I'm currently getting mileage in down the wall and dew-marring on a nearby tree. Could you please clarify something about climbing in a team of three? I'm contemplating doing this on my first trip, and I agree with the number of the benefits you identify in a team of three. However, could you please explain the process for a simpleton like myself? So the leader, once he reaches the belay, fixes the lead line and haul line. Unless the leader is trailing a tag line and then brings up the haul line and the spare lead line, I assume in a team of three that one person has to dew-mar the haul line. I further assume this is done in one of two ways. Number one, the person jugs the haul line while the haul bag is still on the belay, in which case there should be some slack in the haul line to put in backup knots as he ascends the rope, he or she. Number two, the leader pulls up the slack in the haul line and fixes it to the top belay. When the second person attaches their dew-mar to the haul line, the third person releases the haul bag from the belay and the second proceeds to jug the loaded haul line. The second method seems quicker to me, as the third person, once the haul line is released, can begin to clean the pitch. In the first method, you would have to wait until the second person has jugged the haul line and reaches the belay before he can release the haul bag. However, I'm guessing the second method, while quicker, has a couple of significant drawbacks. Firstly, if the haul bag has to be lowered out, this will be a trouser filler moment for the second climber attached to the haul bag, while the third climber lowers out the haul bag with the combined weight of the climber and the hull bag. Secondly, as the rope will be in tension, as in the hull bag has been released, there is no way the climber jugging the whole line can tie backup knots. Could you please comment on my assumptions here and let me know what you would advise for team of three? Apologies if I have missed something out here or it has already it's already covered in the book. Either way, I acknowledge that this stuff is your profession and I do not expect your advice for free. Please let me know if I can send a donation. Yes, I want lots of money. So teams of three, I'll start with the teams of three. A team of three on a big wall is a good team size because you only have to lead a third of the route, which is good if everyone's like shitting themselves and no one wants to lead anything. So if you're doing like a really hard route, which is kind of scary and every pitch you think you might die on it, then only having to do like, you know, one out of three is kind of handy. You also have less weight. Like if you're doing a route that involves like a long approach or a long ascent, then you're basically two people have the same rack. Three people require the same rack as two people. So you're dividing the rack between three people and all the other gear and stuff. And often you can get away with like one double portal edge and three people. And if you do the right kind of routes, like one person can sleep on a ledge and the others can sleep in the portal edge and things. So you can reduce the weight that way. And generally you're reducing the overall burden, physical and mental burden on the whole team by having three people climbing together. You're also psychologically, it's a lot better. Like if you have any kind of accident or any shit hits a fan, then having three people is way better because you've got three people to sort things out, and which you haven't got when there's two of you. But also the psychological side is often if you're doing a really difficult climb, what happens is the person who's leading, like when they start, their morale is generally can often be very low. Like they think they're shitting themselves about doing this next pitch and they don't know what's going to happen and blah, blah, blah. So their sort of psyche is very low. Like not always, but you know, quite often it's quite low. Where the other person his psyche is super high because they've just finished their pitch and they're like, yeah, let's have it. Let's have some more, blah, blah, blah. And that's one reason why it's quite good to climb in blocks of pitches, like two or three pitches each, and then switch over. So, you know, you maintain the psyche as you're climbing up the wall. But so what happens is the person with really high psyche then sort of sits on the belay for several hours, while the other person who's got no psyche slowly builds up their psyche. And often when if the person is like halfway up the pitch and they come up with a problem and they're like, oh, I don't know what to do. And the person at the bottom might have a very low psyche at this point. And they're like, oh, let's just bail us and let's just go back down or something. So the person sitting on the belay is often just spending the whole time thinking why they should go back down and why, you know, they shouldn't carry on. Where the person who's leading is like, I'm really enjoying this. Like they're really focused in the, you know, it's probably like being, you know, I always like make these gladiatorial analogies, but it's an analogy anyway. But you comparisons where, you know, you're the person who is sitting in the gladiator's waiting room, waiting to go outside, and you can hear all the lions and the crashing of swords and shields. Where the person's actually outside fighting the lions and fighting other gladiators, they're just focusing on the fighting. They're not really thinking, you know, you haven't got time to even think, I don't like this, I want to go. You know, if you start thinking like that, you're going to get killed. So the person who's sitting there on the belay is like the gladiator in the gladiator's waiting room, like going, oh God. And everything's sort of magnified. Like when you're belaying someone and, you know, say you're on an ice route, and you've only got like one ice, there's one ice screw in, and then there's like a 20 meter run out, you know, and the leader's up there and he's like, oh, watch me here. And you're like, oh my God, like if he falls, he's going to take like 40 meter fall and he's going to kill me. We're all going to die. And the belayer, the climber is actually, if you thought he was going to fall off, he wouldn't actually be doing it if he was that high up. and maybe he's even joking. I remember once did a route with Vanessa in Tuolumne, and we got off route, and we ended up going up these pitches with no. I think we might have had a belay. We didn't have any gear in between, and I think there's one bit where I was like, you know, maybe it was like 30 meters above the belay, and I was like, watch me here, you know, with no gear in. So often the belayer has got the most stress, and I know climbing on big walls, the amount of stress that comes down the wall where someone is like, you know, really like, oh, I don't think this is going to hold me here. Like, watch me here. Like, oh God, this is terrible. You know, and they are really, really afraid, but at the same time, they're afraid in a very different way from the person who's sitting on the belay. But if you have a team of three, the chances of everyone being in the same mental headspace at the same time is kind of, you know, it would if you're all sitting on a ledge, you know, all day long in a thunderstorm. But generally, it waxes and wanes. People are up now, down now. It depends on how much you've eaten, if you're thirsty, and all these kind of things. So, but usually, if you get two people sitting together, it tends to take the edge off it because they can talk about other things. They can, if you're just by yourself and your mate's like, oh my God, I'm going to die here. I'm going to die. Oh my God, watch me here. Oh God, I'm going to die. Like if you're just sitting by yourself on a ledge, like you really feel for that person and you feel like you're up there with him. But when there's two of you, it's almost kind of funny in a way, like you know, the ridiculousness of the situation, it kind of takes, takes the edge off it. So team of three is very, very good. But if you don't do it right, then it can be quite slow because if you're all incompetent, then you're magnifying it by one or more. And if you have one person who's a bit incompetent, then the other two can sort of carry them. And if you have two that are incompetent, then maybe that other person, if they really got the shit together, they can manage it. But if there's all three of you are incompetent, then you've kind of had it really. So I've done quite a lot of guiding and things with people where there was, you know, I've basically done it up to like sort of five people with only one person who seemed to know what they're doing. And it is possible, but it takes a lot of kind of experience. You can't be looking after other people if you're really like focusing 100% on yourself because you don't know what the hell you're doing. So that's kind of important. So having a really good, like each individual in that team, like so here, like Ian, who wrote this email, like he's obviously doing lots of training down the climbing wall and stuff. And if you want to climb a big wall, then like if you want to do ice climbing, then you're really very limited what training you can do. You know, maybe you could like climb up and down a dead tree or something, but you're very, very limited. You can focus on your fitness and, you know, tying knots or whatever. You go and, you know, go and rent some space in a fridge and go and sit in it and get used to being in the cold. But with big wall climbing, now big wall climbing doesn't just mean like aid climbing. It means like big wall, like free climbing, you know, climbing multi-pitch, kind of difficult multi-day walls. You can do like a lot of training, and a lot of the things that really screw climbers up is like the dew marring, hauling, just little things that don't seem that important. And like when I wrote Higher Education, it was as much for like aid climbing is like a dying thing. It's good fun, and it's not fun. It's like, you know, category two fun, but it's an interesting exercise, mental exercise. But mainly one reason I wrote it was that you met more and more like free climbers who were, you know, going to climb, you know, free routes, and they just had no clue because they always thought that, oh, like aid climbing, that's all that dew marring and hauling and all that stuff, and I'm a free climber, I don't need to know all that kind of stuff. But if you're going to climb these kind of walls, either free or aid and free or new routes, then you really need to learn all this shit about dew marring and hauling and fixing ropes and, you know, using portal edges and, you know, how to descend if, you know, things go wrong with all this gear and stuff. So that was one reason why I wrote the book. You can just sort of remove a whole chapter of it. If you're not interested in aid climbing, then you can remove a whole chapter of that, not read that chapter. But even then, what people don't realize is a lot of, you know, free ascents of big walls are actually aided. People aid the pitch first, might place gear or work it all out. So, you know, like someone like Leah, you know, Leah Holding or, you know, people like that, they, you know, they actually can, they know how to aid climb. So it's just a skill that's kind of good to know. So, but Ian's obviously focusing on the dewmarring and everything else. And it's, but it's also really important that you all, if there's three of you, that you're all training together and learning all these things together. You don't want someone who's just going to like rock up and be kind of clueless. And a lot of the training, you want to make it as difficult as possible. Like, yeah, go down the climbing wall and learn to dewmar up a free hanging rope, and then learn to dewmar up a rope that's on a vertical wall. Then learn to dewmar up a rope on a slab. And then learn to dewmar up a rope that's on a slab and it's going through lots of gear, and then, you know, just kind of build it up, and eventually you want to be on a, ideally, you know, like a really steep wall, like, you know, 15, 20 degree overhanging wall with the ropes going from across from one route to another. So it's like zigzagging by several meters all the way up the wall. You'll have to do this when there's no one around, probably. So you're making it as difficult as possible, but also just the technique of dewmarring up a free hanging rope is really important if you're fixing ropes, if you're you know, because you have to often the ropes, you don't really want the ropes touching the rocks. If you're on like an overhanging route, you know you want the ropes just coming down. So it means you're dewmarring a free hanging rope, which is, you know, pretty nasty kind of stuff, hard work. So you want to be fit, really. So especially here, we're talking about, you know, the leader of the team is at the top B layer, and there's two climbers, the seconds on the bottom B layer, and until someone is leading again, like nothing is happening, no one's going anywhere. So the leader is like the tip of the spear, or like a train. Maybe the train's a better analogy. Is the team is like a train, and the train has to keep going. So the duty of everyone on that train is to keep the train going. So ideally, like when you're short fixing, so you can short fix in a team of three. Is a short fixing technique would be the leader gets to the B layer, and they're on a 60 meter rope, and the B layers are only 40 meters apart. So he pulls up 20 meters, the 20 meters of slack between the B layer, the left in the rope, and they attach that to the B layer with a alpine butterfly, and they then clip into the slack of the rope with a gree-gree or a clove hitch or nothing at all, and then they start soloing up the next pitch. They're self-belaying themselves up the next pitch. And as soon as they set off, then the seconds, one jugs up the whole line, one jugs up the lead line. So basically the leader, the tip of the spear, the front of the train, is only stopping long enough to tie into the B layer and start soloing the next pitch. And when the second gets to the B layer, they put the leader back on B layer, they untie the alpine butterfly, and they B layer the leader, and the whole bag comes up. And that's like a very quick method of doing it, and maybe that leader might lead like one third of the route in one block, so that you're actually going from individual pitches to, like, we'll break the route up into thirds. And that's a really good tip if you want to climb a route, a big wall, in a day. That's the best way to do it. So you would think climbing as a three is not very good for speed if you're climbing a big wall in one day. And it is fast if there's two of you, if you're super fit and super motivated and everything else. But for most people to lead like half, you know, 500 meters of climbing, some of it could be like difficult, tiring, whatever, it's very easy just to like run out of steam. So by having a team of three, it means that you always have, you always stay a lot fresher. And you can even get to the point where, like, some, if you're speed climbing on like a technical wall, then I would say, like, often the pitches might take like an hour an hour to lead some pitches. Some harder pitches might take an hour. So if the, you know, if the route's got less than 24 pitches, you know, some pitches only take 10 minutes, some pitches take an hour and a half, whatever. So you, but the averaging out is, you know, ideally if you want to do it in less than in a day, one day cent, you want to break them all down so you're average them out, what the pitch is going to be. But if someone's like leading a pitch, it's going to take an hour and you're on a ledge, then, you know, one person can actually have a sleep. So you can, you know, like all you don't need to sleep like 15 minutes, 20 minutes, makes like a huge difference. So in terms of speed, like that is quite a good thing. And I think I've climbed El Cap in a day a few times. And climbing as a three was definitely the most kind of fun way of doing it. So the two techniques he like highlights here, one is the leader gets to the belay. You know, conventionally the leader gets to the belay, sets up the belay, attaches the whole line to the belay and the lead line to the belay, so they're fixed to the belay. So the lead line's fixed, so the second can jumar up, taking all the gear out, ready to hand over to whoever's leading, and the whole line is fixed. And generally you'd fix it into the pulley. You probably have like a pro traction or something. You've put it through to the pulley, and you would like the end of the whole line is backed up to something else. Like you never really want to have someone's life hanging by the cam of a pulley. Now technically, you know, if you were being super safe about this, then you wouldn't have it through the pulley. You would put that up. You would put that through after the person had jumared up the whole line. And then the whole bag was going to come out, but often you don't really. So if you want to be super safe, you could put the rope through the pulley and then release the cam on the pulley, and then have the rope tied off with a munter hitch, and that would mean that if you forgot. It's always good to be able to have the whole line releasable in case you forget to actually have the pulley attached. Because if you've got the whole bag attached with a figure of eight knot and it's clipped into a bolt on the belay, and someone releases the whole bag and it's going to be very difficult to sort that out. But if it's passed through something, or if it's releasable, so you'd have it. So the rope would come up, it would go through a munter hitch that's tied off with a munter mule, and then it goes up, and then it's clipped in to the bolt with a knot and a carabiner. And it means that, you know, if you do make a, you know, the person's hanging off a munter hitch that's backed up with a carabiner anywhere, and it's tied off, so it's kind of releasable. But in this first method is the second person or the third person, as soon as the belay is fixed, they like clip into the whole line, and they just like climb the whole line like hell for leather up to the belay, and then they would like probably take some of the rack that's there, whatever rack's left, and then they would try and start leading the next pitch. But to do that, you either have to, when you fix the lead line to the belay, you have to pull all the slack through, so you've got like that 20 meters of slack you've got it at your end, and you can pull up some of the whole line before you start hauling, so you've got that as well. So maybe you give this new leader 20 meters of rope to play with, you give them what rack you've got, and then you just get them off the belay. Like, even if they only climb 2 meters, 3 meters, they've actually, you know, they've made some progress, and also they're not on the belay. So you really want to avoid like everyone being on the belay at the same time for various reasons. So the other way he mentions here is that the leader isn't trailing a haul line, he's trailing a zip line, which is a, you know, like a 8 millimeter, 7 millimeter, 9 millimeter rope, you're often like dynamic rope. And when they get to the belay, they pull up the lead line, they pull up the whole line with that rope. And often you pull up the whole line, and where they're connected, you have the pulley. If you're doing like something really, really hard aid climbing, you don't want to be carrying the pulley, the Cordelettes, all that kind of crap, your Jumars, all that kind of stuff. So you'll often just pull up all that stuff within on the end of your zip line along with the haul line. So you bring everything, you pull up everything you need to build an anchor at that point. So it reduces the weight. And if you want, at that point, you could also have some extra rack as well. You would pull up a bag that's got some rack in it to give to the next person who's leading, some extra bit of gear. But then it starts getting a little bit heavier to pull up by hand, so it's often not worth doing that. So you pull that rope up, and then now you've got the zip line up there, and you've got the end of the haul line, and you've got the gear. So when the person zooms up the haul line, they've already got the zip line there, so they can just tie into that. They don't need the haul line. So the haul line is in separate. So the person could even lead the entire next pitch. It doesn't matter. They don't need the haul line. They've got the zip line, and let me think. So the other way of doing that in an old sort of speed climbing system was one person with Jumar up the haul line with the lead line, with the next lead line. They have a spare lead line attached to their harness. And so as soon as he got there, they would have like the end of the haul line, and then they'd have a whole new lead line, and then they would have the zip line, and they'd all be up there then ready to start leading. And they might also Jumar up with some extra rack on them as well. So, but that is a bit of a pain. Like it's actually hard work Jumaring up a free hanging rope anyway, and it's even more hard work Jumaring up with a lead line hanging off your harness and an extra rack and everything else. So for me, I really like, if you want to keep going really, really quickly, then I like the short fixing method, because it just works really, really well. It's really, really simple. So the second option, so basically, until the second person Jumars up the haul line, the haul bag can't be released. So that is kind of slowing things down somewhat, but not if you you can get that next person leading. It doesn't really make any difference, really. Then the only thing that's holding things back is you're not going to get the rest of the rack until the pitch has been cleaned below. So it's all these things. There's lots of conflicting, you know, question problems and things. And then the other thing was, like, could you just release the haul bag with the person attached to the haul line? So the haul bag and the haul line they're all the same thing. Now, I have done this quite a lot. Like, I don't like doing it if you've got, like, you know, a horrendous amount of weight on the haul bags. Like, if you've got you want to do it when you've got a good haul line, you need like a 10 mil haul line. Like, I wouldn't be doing this with anything really, really skinny, because if there's any chance of it going over any kind of edges, like one person Jumaring up a haul line by themselves is kind of okay. But if you have a haul line weighted down but with one person and, you know, 100 kilos of water, and when you release that bag, the haul line rubs against, you know, something sharp or whatever, then that's really kind of dangerous. So, like, it's dangerous when there's a person hanging on it, but it doubly so when there's, like, that much weight, that much weight on it. Vanessa's now trying to, like, sneak out of the room now. She must have finished her newspaper. So, but if you've got a lightish haul bag, then it's not, you know, if you're speed climbing, you know, you're doing like a one day ascent, you've not got that much stuff. You've just got water in the haul bag. You haven't got all the other stuff. So I think it's kind of fair, really. The thing you want to do, well, one thing you should never do is ever get the person to carry anything unless it's a slab. Like, if you do route like Lurking Fear and El Cap, it's all pretty slabby, so you can actually Jumar with quite a heavy rucksack full of water and stuff for a one day ascent. But, you know, as soon as it gets steep, it's like a nightmare, and it just saps the strength of the person Jumaring, and it slows everything down. So everything that's heavy should be hauled up. So personally, I would probably go to be safe. Like, if it's one of these things, if you have to ask the question, then the answer is you got to go with something. You know, you got to go with the safest option, because if you don't quite understand the dangers involved, then that's dangerous. So I would just go for, say your aim is to do the nose on El Cap, and there's three of you, then I would probably just try and focus on, like, you're going to lose, you might lose some time if you're doing this badly. But if you can get it good at Jumaring and you can get slick at, like, changeovers, then I would probably go for where one person leads. So on the nose, you're probably not going to need, you're not going to want a zip line. You want to keep everything simple. So you're probably going to have, like, a whole line, and you can have a lead line, and that's going to be it, really. And you can have a lower outline for your whole bag. So if the leader gets to the B layer, and they just pull up some slack on the lead line and on the whole line, but no, you have to leave enough slack for the person who's cleaning to be able to lower themselves out if you're on a, you know, and things at B layers and stuff. So it doesn't want to be super tight, but pull up some slack. If you've got, like, a 70 meter rope, 60 meter rope, pull up 10 meters of rope on both ropes. Tie off the whole line with an alpine butterfly into the B layer. The other end is still tied off, clipped in anywhere, and feed it through the hauler. Get the hauler set up to haul. The second person jumars up the whole line as fast as they can. As they're jumaring up, the last person on the B layer is sorting everything out. You know, sorting out the ropes, sorting out the rack, getting ready to jumar. They get their jumars on the rope, like ready to go. They've got the gree-gree on the rope. You know, when you're jumaring, you jumar with the two jumars and a gree-gree. And then as soon as the second, like, hits the B layer, the whole bags are lowered out, and they can just, like, hang there. And while the whole bags are hanging there, the next leader can get on the ends of both the ropes and start leading the next pitch. And as soon as they start leading the next pitch, the person who's left on the belay should probably start trying to haul as they're belaying the leader on their gree-gree to just get the, because ideally you want the whole bag to be coming up at the same kind of speed as the leader, as the second who's cleaning. And that means they're in the right place to sort out the whole bags if something happens. Like, I don't really like the whole bag ever being above anybody, above the second, because unless it's super steep and there's no problems, but, you know, there's always that chance it's going to knock something down on them or whatever. And that way you're just reducing the amount of time as much as possible between the two, when nothing's going on, basically. You just want to keep someone always seems to be moving and doing something to get you up to the wall as fast as possible. And you'll find that the more, you know, as the pitches go on, you'll just find more and more ways to sort of work this out. And you might get to pitches where you might adopt, you know, like that kind of shot fixing kind of technique where you just climb up a bit higher, you solo up a bit higher while others are jumaring up and cleaning. And just be flexible. Like, sometimes, like, at the top of the, you know, at the top of, say, a route like the nose, then your whole bag's a lot lighter. Maybe you can release someone and the whole bag at the same time. Just be flexible with how you do it. But knowing all the different ways of doing it is kind of important. So I hope it would be good to have some diagrams. But I will eventually start trying to do this on YouTube so I can actually draw a little diagram and show you what I'm talking about. But I don't have a webcam or anything to do that. So right, so. Another question. Oh, this is a mini big wall question here. Hey Andy, I'm looking into buying a portal ledge, and everyone seems to have BD ledges. I know there are lighter ledges out there. Is there a reason for the abundance of black diamond ledges, survivability, or something I'm missing? Cheers for the climbing stock I've got from you over the years, Andrew. So black diamond ledges are probably the most common, because black diamonds, the brand, you're gonna, you know, it's like a global brand. You see it everywhere. They sponsor a hell of a lot of people. A lot of people, you know, have black diamond ledges and have not bought them. But I would say, being highly critical, I would say the black diamond ledge is maybe the worst ledge. But I'm on, not the worst, not as in it's a bad ledge. But it's I'm not very good at, like, stuff about cars. It's I don't know. It's basically a ledge for the masses. Basically, You know, it's not very cheap. It's very, very, very heavy. It is kind of strong, but it has, you know, it's basically the history of these ledges was you have all sorts of ledge history. I won't go into it because it's kind of contentious and people get upset about it because, you know, some people think they designed one thing and blah blah blah. So anyway, but the recent history of the ledges was you had like A5 sort of became like probably like the dominant kind of thing. You have like fish, like the fish ledges, which are more, I would say that fish ledges are more like boutique, really. Like I would fish, like Russ Walling, who makes fish ledges, he's like, you know, like Kill Bill, you know, he's a bit like that. He's a bit like the sushi chef who's like making samurai swords. So fish is like one guy living in I don't know where he lives now, like Joshua Tree or somewhere. Lives in Joshua Tree, and he's probably not sure he's an alcoholic, but basically he doesn't live on the same commercial world, which is a good thing as everybody else. You know, he just seems to work when he wants to work, and he sometimes makes some ledges and all this kind of stuff. And he's kind of old school, he's a really old school guy with like tons of experience. And I think like the stuff he makes is like really, really fantastic as well. So I have lots of fish gear. But then you have like John Mindorf, he had A5 ledges, and John worked for Russ, and there's a bit of stuff going on there that I wouldn't like to say what's going on. But the A5 ledges, you know, like took it onto another level. It became like more of like a global brand, and you know, people using A5 ledges over the world, and John, right, really innovated, and you know, the ledge is very light, and you know, we use on some of the hardest big walls, like ever climb, so like, you know, very, very kind of practical. And then John sold his company to the North Face, and for a while they kind of kept making them, and then they just kind of turned into like a bouldering brand that had nothing to do with big wall climbing. And then you had like, then Conrad Anker, he started Ace Portal Ledges, Anker climbing equipment. So these are basically taking like, John Middendorf's kind of A5 kind of thing, and then moving up like another level. It was, you know, like Conrad Anker's like, you know, credible big wall climber, like super experienced big wall climber, lots of experience, you know. So he added some more design elements to it. I don't know if during that period that the portal edges started getting like more and more heavy, heavier. and then I think Black Diamond had their folding ledges, they had these folding portal edges. I can't remember the call now. It was a bit like a deck chair or something. And they were actually quite good, but they weren't very strong. So they were very pretty flimsy. They were quite flimsy portal edges, but they kind of worked. They kind of worked in like a North America, you know, Yosemite kind of thing. They were fine anyway. But eventually they scrapped those, and I think they bought the designs off Conrad Anker. So Ace ledges became the new kind of Black Diamond ledges. But I think maybe just to do with who you were selling them to, and it's like, you know, a huge company, and you haven't got the same sort of margins. Like if you're building a spy plane for the CIA, you know, you can get away with something pretty radical and specialized. Where if you're making, you know, a jumbo jet for the world's airlines, you can't do the same. It has to be like very different kind of thing you're making. So I think that's what happened with the portal ledges. So the Black Diamond ledges are, you know, super solid, I would say, but they have some failings. They're not perfect. And a lot of my interactions with Black Diamond portal edges, I've had lots of negative experiences, like fly sheets which were too tight to get the ledge into, and all sorts of things. Like anyway, so people seem to have a lot of problems with Black Diamond ledges. Yeah, But that might be because they're so popular, like everyone's got one. So if you were climbing in, say you were just climbing in Yosemite, and you know you rock up and it's like 200 yards to the base of a big wall, and you know then the Black Diamond ledges are great for that and things. But the weight is like a serious concern if you're doing anything where you have to carry it like a distance. And probably you know, soloing and stuff has made me much more conscious about this. Now my current ledge is a fish ledge, and I would say that fish ledge is probably half the weight, maybe. I don't know, it feels like pretty light compared to a Black Diamond ledge. Now another thing with the Black Diamond ledge is you used to have like an alpine double. You have a single ledge and an alpine double, which is about a third bigger than a single ledge for two people, and it's, you know, it's pretty small, but it's, you know, it's not, you're not designed for super comfort, designed for like practical, you know, use on a big wall. And then A5 brought out the Cliff Cabana, which is like a luxury giant ledge. And that's one problem, is the Black Diamond double ledge is actually a Cliff Cabana, so it's like a very, very big ledge, where a fish ledge is pretty small. Like if you're like, I'm 5'8" and it's just about the right size for me. Like any bigger, my head would be poking out the side. And you have to be quite good friends with somebody. Like I've spent up to like 10 nights in it with another person, you know, every night. And you have to be pretty, you have to get on very well. You know, there's no wanking or anything. You have to be able to tell straight away. So it's, but it's, you know, as I say, it's like very, very light. And also it's made out of steel. Like a fish ledge has got steel tubing with alloy corners, where most ledges, it's alloy tubing with alloy corners. So the alloy ones do get bent more, you know, do get damaged more easily. Like my A5 double ledge I had, that got bent. It still works, but it's pretty knackered. Because someone, you know, was pulling up onto the B lane, they just grabbed over the ledge and they kind of pulled themselves up on the portal edge, and it just bent the portal edge. So once a portal edge starts getting bent, you're pretty screwed. Like you just can't get it to go back together very easily. And the ease of putting your portal edge together is kind of important. And the other ledge is the Metolius portal edge, which again I think I would just say that was another like Yosemite portal edge. I would look at the prices. But recently you've got John Middendorf's brought out a new load of portal edges, which are really good. Is it grade 7? Is that somebody else's? I can't remember. I've got what John calls them now. Anyway, John's got some new portal edges out, and some are made in Australia and some are made by Runout Customs, and Runout Customs makes portal edges as well. So it's got very, very complicated buying a portal edge. But I would say I would really, really look at the weight of the portal edge. Now that is like super, 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 super important. And I would also look at how easy it is for the portal edge to get put up. Now I would say those two things mean that the Black Diamond portal edges are not the ones to look at. I would either look at let's have a look. So I'll just, my brain, I am going to see now. John, let's have a look. John Middendorf. Can't spell. God, why's got a weird name? John Middendorf. Now his, portal edges. I think I'm having too much sugar. My brain's not working. So his D4. Yeah, D4. So, probably you'd, at the moment, probably I would either get like a, look at getting a D4 portal edge, or I would probably get a fish portal edge, a double whammy fish portal edge. Now a fish portal edge is, you know, I don't think it's probably changed for like 20 years. It's like super, super old school. It's like a Kalashnikov portal edge, where a D4 portal edge is more like a Tesla kind of portal edge. You know, but they're all highly specialist. But yeah, so look at the price, look at how easy it is to put up and down, because that is like a massive deal. You know, when you're knackered, when you're hanging on the on a wall and you're not on a ledge, you just want something that goes up very, very easily. Now, I would say John's D4 portal edges go up like, you know, the easiest as well. And then you've also got these like pod ones as well, the pod inflatable portal edges, which are just one, you know, one person portal edges. But that's another thing altogether. But so anyway, weight, also include the price, weight, price, and ease of erection, how easy it is to get erect on a big wall. So that's so anyway, so I don't want to be talking for too long about all this crap. So what are we on, 40 minutes? Maybe I'll, what's this one? I've got one about a picture. I can't do that on a podcast. Oh, this is funny. This is a funny one. Hi, Andy. Really enjoying your podcast. In one of your earlier episodes, you mentioned that there are some people who just aren't cut out for climbing, looking at their harness and wondering which way to put it on, etc. I am worried I might be one of these people. It certainly takes me a while to learn new knots, techniques, etc. I am not a very visual learner, so I really have to do things myself quite a few times before I understand something. My questions are people like me a lost cause when it comes to climbing? Do you have any advice on how one might get over the learning difficulty? Many thanks, Johnny. So Johnny. So a few years ago, I went to this. I had to speak at the. I don't like to talk about my work with the military. You know, I like to keep it secret. But I was doing some work with the military, and they were talking about fighter pilots. Now, fighter pilot probably is, you know, is up there with probably one of the most technically demanding, high stress jobs that probably exists in the world. You know, there's like no room for mistakes, and you know, it takes like years of training and you know, all this kind of stuff. And they were saying that they have like, I think it was like a 70% failure rate for people trying to go through the process of becoming a fighter pilot. And then what they realized was you go into this training, you somehow go through the system, you come out as a fighter pilot, you're a fighter pilot for a number of years, then you start training people as a fighter pilot, and you know, coming up with the methodology of training people and systems and everything else, and you know, evaluating fighter pilots, and then you know, and that's how, you know, so you're bringing the next generation of fighter pilots. But what they realized was all the fighter pilots, basically anyone who couldn't learn in the same way as a fighter pilot instructor who'd thought out all these courses, then they were just discounting all these other people, which was, you know, there was a story recently about, I read about a guy, and he went to psychology, I think he went to a psychology degree, and he got like a C in his like introductory kind of course in it, and decided he would do maths instead. And the psychology professor had said, oh, someone, you know, I can't remember his name now, but he's like, oh, you have the same name as one of the world's greatest psychologists. And I reckon, you know, he'll remain the only well-known psychologist, you know, because basically you're an idiot. You're not going to do very well in psychology. And so he decided he would do maths instead. So he switched to maths. But then he was really, really bad at maths as well. So he was getting like Fs in maths. So he thought, well, I'll just keep doing psychology. Anyway, ended up being like 20 years later, he's like one of the most famous psychologists in the world. And it was just that his way of learning and thinking about things was different from how it was being taught at the time of being tested. So this thing about the pilots, they decided they would get all these. They realized they were discounting people who could be fantastic pilots because they just couldn't learn in the same way as others. And if you could learn in that way, you know, if you were a visual learner or whatever, then you would go through the system, you know, really, really well. So they did this test where they got all these people together, these fighter pilots, and they said, right, we want you to learn how to do a bunny hop, and we're gonna you have 1 hour to learn to do a bunny hop. And they're like, here's a manual, you know, like this 50 page manual of how to do a bunny hop. We want you to do a bunny hop in 1 hour. So one group of people, they ran off and they started reading this manual, like reading every single page of the manual. Other people, they didn't even look at the manual, they just got on the bike and they started like doing like just trying to do bunny hops. And other people were just trying to do bunny hops and they were just talking through it like, right then, I have to put my hand, put my foot here, I have to shift my weight forward. Anyway, so everyone was, other people were like watching everybody else, like how they did it, you know, asking people how they did it and all this. And so, you know, the people who read the book, you know, they would read the whole book and then at the 50th minute, they would just get on the bike and do a bunny hop straight away. So it kind of taught them how there's lots of different ways of learning things. And climbing is a sport where if you're able to like watch like a YouTube video, someone explaining like how to set up a belay, then you can in your mind, certain people they can imagine themselves doing it, they can visualize how the, you know, how everything would go, the sound of the carabiner, how the, you know, the carabiner going through the bolts, the knots being tied. And they can learn really, really easily. In the same way, like when I was talking just now about climbing as a three, some people will like totally get it, where other people will be like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like they want you to draw a diagram. They like want you to, you know, take them in a field and they want to physically show them. But there's no way of learning which is wrong. And it can be frustrating when you're trying to teach somebody how to do something and they just don't, they can't learn in the way you're teaching. So I'm really, really bad at maths. I'm really bad at, because I think it's an abstract thing I can't hold in my mind. So I had no idea what a square number is until someone just got four stones and said, look, I don't know what square number that is, but here's four stones. You know, that's four, that's a square number. And then they put like nine stones around, you know, made it into nine stones. Is that right? Nine stones? It should be eight stones. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine. Nine stones. And they're like, and that nine is like a square number. And I was like, I totally get it. You know, not that much, but I kind of understand what it was. So I'm no good at anything like that. Like when I'm a big fan of, if anybody watched Joe Rogan and Eric Weinstein the other day, I love Eric Weinstein. He's like one of my favorite, you know, podcasters. Is it Weinstein? Anyway, but you know, he started talking about this stuff about, you know, spinners and string theory, and I was like, Christ Almighty, I just, you know, it made no sense whatsoever. So maybe Johnny here, he's like, he knows what he's talking about, but I have no idea what he's talking about. So I would say, I would just, like, if you're climbing already, then you obviously can learn to climb, but maybe you just have the way you're learning, you're just learning in your own fashion. And also we do tend to fill our minds with a lot of junk techniques and ideas that aren't really necessary, just because, you know, like we make a living out of like writing books, you know, like 300,000 word books about stuff where you could just probably learn it, you know, learn it in a few days anyway. You don't need to. So, but some people want to read and learn that way. And other people will just do it and learn that way. And other people will watch other people and they need someone to actually teach them how to do it. Like a physical human being has to say, like, now do this, put this through here. So I'll finish with this story about someone I know who went climbing with a guy who was like a world famous physicist, Oxford University, who was also a rock climber. And this guy lived in a completely separate reality to everybody else. You know, you have on the like dyslexia spectrum, I think dyslexic people are generally people who are, you know, they're good at learning, you know, from looking at things, and you're not very good at, maybe not so good at reading how to learn things, but they're just good at visual learners. They like to pick up things and, you know, touch them and play around with things, fiddling with things. Where on the other spectrum, I'm not sure if like autistic spectrum is the opposite end to the dyslexic spectrum. Like those people like just basically live in their heads, you know. They have very little need for the physical body or people around them. They just totally live in their heads. So this guy, they went rock climbing together, and they said, oh, can you make make breakfast? And there's this horrible smell. And he'd actually put the sausages in the frying pan in the plastic wrapping. So here's like one of the most intelligent people in the world who didn't know how to fry some sausages. So yeah, so that's, you know, so yeah, so I don't think, I have climbed with people who didn't know how to put the harnesses on properly. You know, they would, you know, they couldn't work out where the leg loops went and what foot went where. But it didn't make the, it often didn't mean they were bad climbers. They're often really, really good climbers. But they didn't fill their heads full of stuff they didn't need to know. They were safe, but they just had to walk a different walk basically through life. So I'll the helicopter's flying around outside my house here. So I'll call that a day. And so tomorrow I'm going to do another podcast, reading out a bit of writing, talking about not the art of writing, but the stuff of writing. So speak to you then.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.